You know, I think the interesting question here in some ways is what's China's pathway out? And when I look at this, I think it's possible that the Chinese government is looking at the current instability and thinking, okay, this is bad. This is not what we want. But we've pinned a lot of our legitimacy on zero COVID and the fact that not as many people have died as in other places.
Welcome to the Hopkins podcast on foreign affairs. I'm Chris Park from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Thousands of people are joining protests across China focused on challenging the zero COVID policy. The ongoing demonstrations display rare solidarity between class, region, and even ethnicity. We recorded this episode a day after the death of former General Secretary Jiang Zemin. Will his death further galvanize protesters? What are the exit options for the party state? Dr. Sheena Chestnut Greitens joins us to discuss the protests in China. Dr. Greitens is an associate professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, where she directs the school's Asia Policy Program. She's a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and an associate in research at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hopkins podcast on foreign affairs. Well, Dr. Greitens, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
I'm happy to be here. Look forward to the conversation.
Well, it's been a busy month, a couple of months in China. We've had the American semiconductor restrictions, the 20th Party Congress. And now the topic of today's conversation is on the ongoing protests in China. And we have been seeing videos spreading on social media of protesters across China in the streets of Shanghai, in university campuses, and elsewhere. How did these protests start? And what are the protesters calling for?
Well, that's a great question. The protests were initially triggered by a fire in an apartment building in Xinjiang that killed around a dozen people. And the fire was seen as the result of the zero COVID policy that the Chinese government has been pursuing for over 2 years now. And so a lot of the protests have been focused on calling for an end to some of China's zero COVID measures. But we've also seen actually that in a number of cases, the protests have spilled into more generalized discontent and popular dissatisfaction with the policies of the Chinese leadership and of local governments, but also with the nature of the political system. And so, you know, this is a really unusual time in terms of protest dynamics in China. It's not uncommon to see localized issue-specific protests pop up in China multiple times a year, but to see a nationwide wave of protest by different people across different locations, all focused on a common grievance and a common issue, really is more unusual, and I imagine is making the Chinese leadership pretty nervous.
To get a better sense of kind of the scale of the protest, are there particular demographics of people that are participating in the protests, or are the protests particularly concentrated in, you know, a given area of China?
Well, there are a lot of students who are protesting. I think that I saw somewhere that something like 80 or more universities in China had student demonstrations recently over this set of issues. But what's actually one of the things that's quite interesting about this wave of protests is that it involves more than students. We've seen workers and middle class people and families protesting. And so part of what's interesting is that there isn't sort of one demographic profile. This doesn't seem to be restricted just to students. And honestly, you know, cross location, cross class, cross issue, and maybe even cross ethnic mobilization is something that the Chinese Communist Party has for a long time worked very hard in its domestic security strategy to avoid. So to see, you know, people saying, well, we are all Xinjiang people, at a time when the regime has really tried to portray Xinjiang as separate and a an isolated security challenge and in some ways a threat to the rest of the country, to actually see solidarity and cross-ethnic mobilization between people in Xinjiang and people elsewhere in China is probably not, something that I would be concerned about and watching closely if I was sitting in a leadership position inside the Chinese Communist Party. And so I think that's part of why we've seen some real effort by the censorship apparatus, as well as by the police now, especially in recent days, to try to figure out how to demobilize people and to censor in ways that prevent this collective action mobilization from becoming an even broader issue and an even broader cross-section of Chinese society.
On the point about cross-ethnic solidarity and mobilization, there is an ongoing, I guess, what the United States, the State Department has called a genocide in Xinjiang. Perhaps a long-standing ethnic conflict between the Han majority in China and the Uyghur minority who predominantly live in Xinjiang. So is the fact that the protests right now are, I guess, triggered by the fire in Xinjiang, is that surprising to you? Or is a cross-ethnic kind of solidarity, has that force always been present to some degree in Chinese society?
No, I think what's interesting is that COVID and the Chinese government's zero COVID policies create a bridge and a common issue, whereas previously, I think the Chinese government's framing had been successful at emphasizing difference and at making the sort of the threat of terrorist violence in Xinjiang, which it manipulated public perceptions of. If you look at domestic media coverage and the timing of media coverage of incidents in Xinjiang and the way that they're framed, I know there's a book coming out that has some data on this. And my read of that data is that the Chinese government has manipulated its coverage of some of these issues and sort of Xinjiang specific dissatisfaction to portray Xinjiang as a threat to the rest of the country. And so what's interesting is that the zero COVID policy does something very different, and it actually counteracts some of the messaging that the Chinese government's tried to put in place for years now to make sure that the groups and the grievances stay separate. One of the very interesting things is that the Chinese government has had a security strategy for a long time of trying to keep protests localized and grievances atomized so that they don't spread across different locations and different sectors of society. And zero COVID is whether they intended this or not, a policy that can mobilize a lot of different people because it affects everyone. Maybe in different ways, but it's had an impact on a lot of people now because it's been so sustained for over 2 years. And so I think, part of what we're seeing is this reaction to the sense of, the arbitrariness of state authority, the costs of state authority, and the costs of China's current course of action, sort of juxtaposed with the sense that much of the rest of the world has started to be able to move on. So I think one of the interesting things about this was to see the solidarity and the sympathy that was expressed for Xinjiang people because zero COVID was perceived as a common pain point. And we also have to remember, it wasn't just the Xinjiang fire, right? There was the bus crash, a few weeks ago, where a number of people died in eastern or central China. I can't remember exactly where, but a number of people died in a bus crash on the way to a quarantine center, and other places where there has been opposition to the costs of lockdown and problems with delivering medical care or healthcare to people. The Xinjiang incident came, and the fire and the casualties of the fire became a focal point, but we also have to remember that they came after a series of other incidents that have occurred in other parts of China. And I think that, you know, that creates a shared sense of, you know, common impact and maybe common opposition. And again, that's something that generally the Chinese political system has worked pretty hard to avoid. So to see, you know, the whole model of China's domestic security and pandemic control both use this phrase prevention and control. That's a phrase that applies to the pandemic management and to public health, as well as to social unrest. And so to see, you know, multiple localized points of failure in that model is pretty striking at this point in Xi Jinping's tenure and in the buildup of the local security state.
Precisely what you said about kind of the common pain point of zero COVID, we're seeing this cross-class, cross-region, and perhaps cross-ethnic protests. And many news reports and commentators have characterized the ongoing protest as the largest since the Tiananmen protests. Are these comparisons accurate or even appropriate? And how do the protests today compare to the nationwide protest in 1989?
You know, I don't have a good way of trying to judge quantitatively the magnitude. We know that the protests in 1989 also, at that point, both Tibet and Xinjiang were under martial law, if I remember correctly. And there were protests in China in 60-some cities. I think right now we haven't quite reached the 60-city level, but that's assuming that we can accurately observe all of the places where protests are taking place. And since there's an active censorship program in place trying to prevent that information from being shared, it's just hard for me to know if we can really accurately measure and compare the scale of the protests right now. I think it is important to note that the protests are not rare in China. They're usually just very specifically aimed at changing a policy. They're often combined with petitioning a local government. There might be about labor issues, about housing issues, about environmental issues, about, you know, veterans compensation. So there are, you know, different protests that there's a sort of repertoire of collective action that actually does occur pretty regularly in China. It's declined under Xi Jinping, as far as we can, you know, the best of our ability measure. I do think it's important to note that it's not so much the fact that protest is occurring that makes it rare. It's that it's simultaneous, that it is cross location, and to some extent across certain sectors and groups of society. So, to me, and then third, I think so. The fact that there is this cross-location and cross-class element, those are two important differences. And then third, that I think, you know, we have seen some transition from targeting a specific policy or the implementation of a specific policy to more generalized dissatisfaction and dissent. So some of the slogans that we've seen chanted have been more system challenging than calling for a specific policy change. And so those are the three ways in which these protests seem to me to be somewhat different.
If we can stay on Tiananmen for just a bit more, I'm thinking back to how the death of former General Secretary Hu Yaobang precipitated the 1989 protests. And we are recording this episode a day after the death of Jiang Zemin. And Jiang Zemin and Hu Yaobang obviously are very different figures, representing different times of China, leadership in Chinese government. Jiang also was not necessarily a champion of openness and political liberalization, but instances, and I've been seeing this on social media a lot, like Jiang Zemin reciting the Gettysburg Address to Mike Wallace, perhaps harkens back to a time when China was a bit more open than it is today under Xi Jinping. Do you think that Jiang's death could have a galvanizing effect on protesters, just knowing what we know now, you know, a day after the death of the former general secretary?
Yeah, I think that potential is there, but that it depends on a couple of different factors that we don't have full information on yet. So first, as you noted, Jiang Zemin and Hu Yaobang are pretty different political figures. And, you know, Hu Yaobang was kind of known as more of a reformer. And I don't think Jiang Zemin has that clear of an identity. And so there may be less mobilization potential in sort of the personality and public perception of who Jiang Zemin was. That said, so that's sort of one side of the ledger. That said, especially if people frame coming into public as commemoration and mourning for Jiang Zemin in a way that is sort of framed as patriotic, that's a lot harder for the party to crack down on. And it may still give people an opportunity to physically come together, come out in public, and to gather, at which point we can see that the protests and conversations can take on a life of their own, and a conversation about zero COVID or Jiang Zemin's death may turn into a more general conversation about China's current state and its future trajectory. So I think there is still probably some real concern about public mobilization and public mourning and the way that is done for Jiang Zemin. And I think that, you know, both the way that the state frames Jiang Zemin's legacy will tell us a lot about the narrative that the state is trying to set, but also the way that people talk about Jiang Zemin's death is also going to be refracted through how they're thinking about China today. And we've already seen some evidence of censoring, for example, conversations about Jiang Zemin's legacy that appear to be implicitly critical of Xi Jinping. So contribution to collective leadership versus, you know, consolidation of power around one single central leader is something that, you know, a contrast that can be drawn by people commemorating Jiang that would be implicitly but not explicitly critical of the direction that China's gone. And so I do think you'll see some attempt at contrast, but again, you know, there's a long history in China of people figuring out how to say that in indirect ways that won't get caught by censors or that are sort of framed in patriotic language or patriotic terms so that people can express their feelings in ways that don't make them an immediate target of the security state. And so I think we're likely to see a little bit of ebb and flow as you know, some of those initial expressions happen and the state figures out how to respond. And we're also going to see, I think, the party state trying to set a narrative that frames Jiang Zemin in terms of continuity with where China is today and in ways that make his legacy as system supporting as possible.
What you said about the party state censoring, you know, or beginning to censor some mentions of Jiang Zemin, you know, and its broader efforts to kind of set the frame, and also the way people are, you know, using expressions to skirt party state censoring, makes me want to kind of step back to ask about the state capacity to manage popular movements. And, you know, earlier in our conversation today, you've talked about how China has always tried to make issues localized, grievances atomized, and really focus on prevention and control. And I recall in October, early October, you wrote in the Foreign Affairs that in an increasingly dangerous world, the party's chief aim is political security. And we've heard so much, and I've read a lot of your articles on Chinese surveillance state and its effort at prevention and control of instability. So what is the Chinese state's capacity in managing these protests? How has China managed popular protests in the past? Is there a standard operating procedure of sorts?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the biggest areas of movement under Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping has really emphasized national security But it's important to know that when the party state talks about national security, they don't mean it the way that people sitting inside the Beltway do when they talk about national security. National security, if you read party documents and you read leadership speeches, the sort of lifeblood or the core of national security is this term political security. And then political security in turn is defined as the stability of the Chinese socialist system, the leadership of the CCP Central Committee, and Xi Jinping at the core of that leadership. And so it really is a regime security concept, not a sort of national security concept as we would typically think about it for the country. It's very much specific to the Chinese Communist Party. And in order to achieve that end, Xi Jinping has really emphasized this phrase, prevention and control. Now, what's fascinating about prevention and control is that he was using it to describe domestic security and managing internal instability. And then it's a term that has some, sort of discursive history in public health. So then when the pandemic happened, it got applied to pandemic management and to zero COVID. And so part of what we see is that the Chinese political system chose to deal with coronavirus, a public health issue or public health crisis, as a sort of public security problem and with a public security framework. And so, not surprisingly, I think that leads you to lockdowns, to the use of grassroots neighborhood committees for, enforcing in the same way that they enforce sort of other social stability goals at the grassroots level. And so you really see this kind of merging of public security and public health in ways that meant that China invested its resources and its time a lot in lockdown enforcement and less in some of the other tools of public health. In terms of the surveillance state, one of the things that's so interesting here is that this is a system that really is aimed not just at stability maintenance and reacting to protest, but trying to prevent its emergence in the first place. And so what we have seen is that system didn't work, at least in an ideal sense, this week. I don't know that I would say it's a complete failure, right? But it certainly didn't work in terms of actually preventing people from mobilizing at all, which is one of the, and it didn't prevent cross location protests, which is one of the things the system is explicitly designed to try to prevent. So to see, there's been this massive investment in the surveillance state, particularly by provincial and local governments, and it didn't work all that well in the last week or two. And so that, I think we haven't fully seen the consequences of that yet. Couple of thoughts about that. First, the sort of central authorities are already trying to shift responsibility and blame to local governments, which is a time-honored tradition in Chinese governance, something bad happens, and the central government comes in and responds to protesters by saying, wow, this local official really screwed up the implementation. That's not how they were supposed to do that. We're going to remove them, maybe discipline them. And we're really on your side. That's a common way for the central government to approach problems. It's not clear that that's going to be as convincing as it usually is for a lot of these local protests, because this is an issue that's been very sort of closely associated with central authorities and with Xi Jinping himself, including at the 20th Party Congress. So it's just not clear to me that this effort to shift responsibility to local officials is going to work. But on the other hand, the surveillance state, it didn't prevent protest from emerging, and it didn't prevent sort of cross-geographic and cross-class mobilization from happening in the way that I think the party would really like. On the other hand, surveillance is still useful after the fact, or in the midst of ongoing mobilization. And so we've now seen already that the authorities are doing things like using video and using facial recognition to identify protesters, sometimes even ones wearing masks, and are either going and visiting them retroactively or even using what we call relational repression, calling their parents, calling their workplaces, calling their friends, calling, you know, anyone who might have a relationship with them, and putting pressure on them as a way of deterring further dissent. And this can be very effective because, for most people, you might be willing to run a risk to yourself. But if you're talking about potentially getting your mother in trouble or getting your parents fired from their jobs, for most people, that is both a different strategic calculus and also a different moral question of moral obligation. And so relational repression can be very effective. And we've seen the combination of, high-tech surveillance, some of these fancy surveillance tools, combined with this social pressure that the Chinese political state is very good at exerting and has done since well before, surveillance cameras were placed in Chinese cities. So, I think we may be at the start of a period where we see a state that was a little bit on its back foot in dealing with, we didn't prevent this. The system was designed to prevent this kind of thing from happening. But I think we may see the party state regroup and that the state capacity that the regime has developed now being used to try to at least stop further mobilization and deter people from continuing to mobilize and to protest. I think that's worrisome because that means we could be seeing the beginnings of an early wave of repression and sort of political crackdown on people who mobilized in the past week. But when you look at the sort of dynamics between protesters and state response, at some point, I think it's likely that the state will sort of regroup and come up with a response to regain control. And so I think we're seeing the early phases of that response now.
What you said about kind of the difficulty of shifting blame and dividing kind of the central government's responsibility from local officials and accordingly shifting blame and the difficulty and your skepticism of how that might not work in this situation, would you suggest that this is a phenomenon perhaps specific to zero COVID and the kind of cross-racial or not cross-ethnic, cross-regional, cross-class aspect of zero COVID? Or is that a more of a broader consequence of Xi Jinping's tenure as general secretary?
I think it has to do with the intersection of the two. So Xi Jinping was clearly interested in adapting China's model of social control to be more preventive. He was clearly interested in investing in what he called a multidimensional information-based system of prevention and control for public and social stability. Right, that language, which is a mouthful in Chinese as well as in English, dates back to I think 2015 as very high-level guidance given to the Chinese political system as sort of here's what you should be trying to develop. Here are the tools you should be trying to develop for this purpose. So that predates the pandemic. I think what happened is that the pandemic was a forcing function. Right? So in 2018, 2019, surveillance cameras were being put in place, but you heard people like Li Keqiang talk about, we're collecting all this information, but it's in silos. It's in information islands, and we can't actually use it effectively for governance. That's the problem we're working on solving. And I think, the pandemic really created a forcing function that both made it imperative that the party state be able to do some of those things, but also allowed them to present it in terms of the public narrative as we're doing this for you. We're doing this to keep you safe. We're doing this to keep people from dying. And it seems to me that bargain has, which was at least tacitly accepted by a lot of people for a while. What we've seen lately is that it's broken down among enough people that they're willing to go out and protest and say, no, this doesn't seem like you're doing this for us. This is not what we want anyway. And so that puts a lot of, a lot more or a different kind of pressure. But I do think that, it was an interaction between a pre-existing desire to strengthen the domestic security apparatus and the surveillance state that existed well before and was in progress well before the pandemic, but that the pandemic really accelerated and in some ways created a separate justification for the consolidation of that system. I think the interesting question here in some ways is what's China's pathway out? And when I look at this, I think it's possible that the Chinese government is looking at the current instability and thinking, okay, this is bad. This is not what we want. But if we've pinned a lot of our legitimacy on zero COVID and the fact that not as many people have died as in other places. And if we try to exit zero COVID quickly, the death rate's going to go up and the whole legitimacy of our effort is going to fall apart. And so we can either do this quickly, but have the whole project sort of the legitimacy of the whole approach fall apart because so many people will die, or, you know, we can try to hang on and navigate our way out of this more slowly, which means accepting some continued economic cost. But that slower pathway out really hinges on there being some way for China to exit zero COVID more safely. And so the biggest mystery here to me has always been why we haven't seen a state that's clearly comfortable compelling people to do things, certain things like lockdown, hasn't pushed vaccination more and earlier. And I actually saw some discussion with Sun Chunlan and some public health officials yesterday, and then an indication from, I think it was Caixin magazine, was talking about potentially setting vaccination targets in Beijing, which would be a very different sort of incentive structure for local officials. Right now, China's problem is that they have low vaccination rates in their highest risk populations, and questions about the efficacy of the vaccine. But the low vaccination rate is something that they could fix with a mass campaign. And so I wonder if this set of protests has shifted their thinking enough that we'll see a policy change. That policy change being some push for a mass vaccination campaign. Still under the framework of zero COVID, but some mass vaccination campaign is an increased piece of that, because the risk of social unrest is getting uncomfortably high. Sustained social unrest is getting uncomfortably high. I wonder if that's the direction we're about to see Beijing go.
So in our podcast today, we are discussing the ongoing protests in China, a really complicated situation that mixes China's long-term search for regime security, surveillance state that focuses on prevention of protest, and failure of that system, dynamics of China's zero COVID policy, and potential ways for China to get out of this uncomfortably prolonged situation, including, as you just said, vaccine goals or more crackdowns. I wanted to conclude our conversation by talking about the American response. The Biden administration has stressed the importance of democratic values in its foreign policy. We're also coming off of the first in-person meeting between President Biden and General Secretary Xi, where the two leaders committed to stabilizing bilateral relations. So how has the Biden administration responded to the ongoing protests, and should it do more?
So I would describe its response as cautious to date. And I think there's some good reason for that. The good reason is that it is a sort of long-standing trope in Chinese political discourse, CCP political discourse, to blame social unrest and protest on foreign instigators, to say, look, this is foreigners meddling in China and stirring up trouble, rather than acknowledging that there is genuine popular dissatisfaction with the policies of the government or the party. And so I think the Biden administration does have to walk a fine line here. I think it needs to express support for the rights of people to protest peacefully, to say, you know, things that are critical of the government, to stick to its values, and to indicate that it opposes and is very critical of repression in China, which it's done at multiple points prior to this week's protests. I think it is important that the administration do that, but I do think it is probably both wise and helpful to do that in a way that doesn't play into the Chinese Communist Party's hands in terms of sort of portraying protesters as foreign agents or agents of foreign subversion or black hands of the United States. That could increase the risk to some of the brave men and women who are out protesting. And it could also delegitimate the protests. I think it's clear if you watch some of the videos. There was a fascinating exchange among some of the protesters where someone raised the issue of foreign forces and somebody said, you know, who, Marx and Lenin? We can't talk to foreigners. We're not here because of that. These are Chinese people and we care about the policies of the Chinese government. And I think it is important to express support for the values and the rights of all people around the world, including in China. But I also think it is tactically wise to make sure that the focus remains where it should be, which is on the fact that these are Chinese citizens protesting against the really harmful and costly impact that Chinese government policies have had. And that's really, again, the cost to the Chinese people really is where the focus belongs. And I note that even Ambassador Burns' message of condolence this morning, which I saw on Twitter, talks about, expressing condolences to Jiang Zemin's family and to the Chinese people. So it's a very carefully worded note of condolence. And again, I think that's the administration trying to walk this line of sticking to its values and expressing support while not playing into the hands of the CCP narrative about foreign subversion. Now, if a crackdown escalates, I think we will probably see the administration reconsider its response and maybe become more forceful in its condemnation of repression. But I think that dynamic more or less explains why we've seen a measured or pretty cautious response to date. We'll see if that changes.
Well, Dr. Greitens, thank you so much for joining us on this wide-ranging and thoughtful conversation. I know our listeners and I will be closely following the ongoing protest, as well as your excellent commentary on this issue.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a fast-moving and important conversation, and I appreciate the chance to be part of it. So thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.